Welcome to the Hall of Blue Illumination, the podcast dedicated to M.A.R. Barker's legendary world of Tecumel.
Today, my esteemed co-hosts include Victor Raymond.
Hi there.
And James Malaszewski.
Greetings.
My name is Scott Kellogg, and we have with us today a special guest, Dave Morris.
Hello.
Welcome to the show, Dave. Would you like to tell us a little bit about how you encountered Tecumel?
Sure. Well, it must have been, I think I'd seen a review in Strategy and Tactics or something like that, one of these 1970s simulation wargame magazines. And I and some friends from school went up to London and found a copy of the original EPT in a little game store called Game Center that's not there anymore. I mean, it was a really tiny little shop, and you would open up all these games and lay them out on the floor. And we got the map of Tecumel out, and we looked at it and thought if we pooled our resources, three or four of us could buy it. So we got that. And I remember coming back on the train, we were looking at the rules and somebody had the map. And one of the guys said, I don't even think this is a war game. And we'd never encountered role playing or anything. We had no idea. And when we started out, we would play on a Saturday, and each player would take a half hour turn. And we were all playing separately. So we knew that the goal was to get things like citizenship. We saw that as kind of victory points. And so we immediately got into our, got out of our boats in Jakarta Harbor. But we were all in different hostels, and we weren't really interacting much. And after a while of that, each player getting half an hour's play, we realized that if we teamed up, we could all get to play all the time. But it was we had no template to go from. So that's where we got started. That was back in about 1975, 1976.
That's amazing. So you didn't have the idea of a referee or a GM that wasn't communicated to you directly through the.
Yeah. So we had a referee because we were used to having umpired war games. So there was one guy was taking each person in turn and giving them half an hour, and then we'd all be sitting there waiting our turn, and then he'd rotate us round. So through the day we'd get half an hour every couple of hours. we were kind of keeping our cards close to our chest, like you'd say to another player. So it looks like you were planning some kind of military expedition. You must have a patron, and I might be going north. But they wouldn't. And then you'd say, well, how are you doing in terms of getting any money or getting anywhere in terms of citizenship? And we'd all be quite cagey. Two players saw the map and they said, we're going to team up and go to the fortress of Hruger. And the referee said, we're first level. He said, you have to realize that you're not Conan. You're the bones that Conan crunches on his sandals as he climbs the temple steps. And nonetheless, they climbed in their little rowboat. And the referee planned the whole of the fortress of Hruger, even though he knew that they would be killed immediately. I don't even think they got through the swamp to the fortress. And in fact, it was a year later that the rest of us teamed up and decided to have a go, because we knew the fortress of Hruger was waiting there. But by this time, we were all 10th or 11th level. So it was kind of, then it was just about doable for all of us. But anyway, that was fun. Early days.
That's interesting that your default mode would be PvP in a way.
Yeah, that's always our default mode. You've seen, maybe we'll get to it later, the court case between Baluri and Camiel. That's Robert
Dale.
Yeah,
that's on the docket for sure.
Right. Well, it's just, we would always be, there's a part, the fun, I think, in our group is the skating that line of being able to get one over on other players or even insult them with etiquette, so that there's no comeback. And occasionally it goes too far, and then there's a duel. So it's kind of like co-opetition. They're a team, and very often they're doing stuff together, but there's always a little bit of They're kind of like spaghetti Western heroes. You know, there's a little bit of what's in it for me. That all the characters kind of think that way, I think. So people have to stay on their toes in our games.
Well, it has become a tacit assumption over time that all of the player characters are on a team or somehow buddies, and there are many ways to make that happen, but it's kind of interesting that that isn't necessarily an assumption in an Empire of the Petal Throne game.
Well, certainly when we got to an unexpected point in our campaign quite some years later, when the players got involved in a civil war between, Selne had become emperor, but Mirosia had declined to be sacrificed and had skipped off somewhere. And the players were all sent to try and find where he was, and they all thought this is terribly dishonorable. And then a group of players went out and found him, and in fact had managed to get him on his own out in the wilderness where near a hunting lodge where he was hiding out. And he talked them around. Half the player group came back and said, we found Mirosia, we spoke to him, and we actually think he should be emperor. And the other guys were going, you're traitors. And the whole party split right down the middle, and we had the whole civil war with the two groups. And one group effectively knew that if they failed, they would all be up for the, you know, impalement stakes. And anyway, you know, they just accept that as the price of, tense gaming.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun. What can you tell us about the Tekemel or Empire of the Petal Throne scene, if there was one, in England at that time?
Well, I'd started a group. Originally, I was in Guildford, and then when I went up to university, I started a group there, mainly because I hadn't really expected, you know, a lot of my players hadn't come with me. Their couple were at the same university, and people were asking me about it, because I guess we just mentioned it in passing. And after, there was enough pressure to put a group together, and eventually we got to the stage of almost having to turn players away. Our player group, I think, ended up with something like 10 players around the table on a full night, and kind of too many, really. But it was interesting to see that, because there wasn't a lot of discussion then, you know, we pre-internet, or, you know, pre-social media anyway, people didn't compare notes on how they played. So I played at one point with a Cambridge group, and they started the session with a kind of a prophecy they were given, or a almost like a treasure hunt. And they had to sit and look at the map and go, oh, this bit with the red hats, that must be Muglavius, we've got to go there. And they kind of like spoon-fed that. They enjoyed it, but it meant that they whipped through a huge, what we would have done over a campaign, they were kind of doing in one session with a lot of hand-holding, you know, to be effectively be told. Whereas our style in the game has always been players have to be self-starters. You know, I'll prepare things as a safety net, but I prefer the players to drive what they want to happen. So, we usually kind of high clan, but not too high. But some of our campaigns have ended up with players running fiefs and as sort of senior generals and so on. So then it becomes a bit more, I guess, like Star Trek, where you're looking at the officers' lives, you know. But the plots tend to be pushed by what the players are interested in. So I like to see what their goals are and kind of just lay the tracks a little bit ahead of where they're going all the time, or preferably improvising as they go, because there's so much material in all the source books that you can really just, when they say we're going to such and such a city, you can go and find what the professor had to say about it, and that's the seed that you build an enormously complex crystal around, but there's enough there to get going.
That's a great description. So you are the author of the Tidikalu role-playing game, which came out originally in the 90s and has recently gone into another printing. Can you tell us a little bit about what prompted you to create those rules?
Right. Well, it was born of frustration originally because I was corresponding with Professor Barker when I was at university, and he would describe, he was very generous with his time. He would send me long, long letters and very patient, I thought, with all the questions that I would be firing off at him, and all the players would ask me to ask questions. But he was telling me about the new EPT, as he called it then. I guess that became Swords and Glory eventually. And just tantalizing little hints, but we were pretty desperate to get our hands on, you know, that thing. And so I did a kind of proto set of rules that we ran for some time, and then Swords and Glory came out. But it was, you know, that was kind of by that stage. And even the professor said, "Well, we don't, on the whole, worry about the rules. We just kind of roll the dice." We wanted something a bit simpler and kind of faster paced, particularly when it came to fights and so on. So I dusted off my prototype rules and gave them to Rikalu, partly because I then make me keep doing the Eye of All Seeing one, the fanzine that I was working on, because, you know, otherwise I wouldn't have had a project to complete it. They kind of get into deadline. And the kind of underlying, some of the underlying principles were intuiting from what the professor had said in notes of what he was trying to do. Kind of design ethic was coming across from things like, if you hit, we have a D10 for damage. And I was thinking, okay, so he's not saying it's just weapon plus strength or anything. So from that, I was thinking, well, what if it's a D10 that references your skill as well as the weapon? So in Turikalu, you roll and you cross-reference it with your skill in that weapon. And the weapon itself is just a modifier to the dice roll. But so you might, if you're very, very skilled, the table might say for D10 roll, 6, 6, 7, 7, 8, 8, 9, 9, 10, 10. So you wouldn't do less than 6 points, even with a dagger. Although a dagger would be like -2 on that table, so you wouldn't get the 10. So just little things like that that probably weren't what the professor was driving at. But, you know, given, so we were given crumbs of information, and I was building this whole idea of what the rules ought to be from that. And I, you know, we played with Turikalu, kind of evolving it as we went. But I found that with a group of players, as I had, that are very imaginative, the difference between that and, say, something like GURPS 4th edition, which is what we very often use now. And I like the breadth of GURPS, you know, that it covers so many things. But it does tend to favor you deciding what you're trying to do, working it out in enormous detail, and then it tells you what you have to roll to have achieved that complex maneuver in a combat, say. And in Turikalu, you just say to players, you're given the choice of doing a full action or a half action. So as it counts down in initiative and it comes to me, I could full attack, I could half attack, or I could wait. And if I full attack, I'm using all of my combat value for the round, so I've got nothing left for defense. If I half, then I'm hedging my bets. So I've got the choice to either defend later or do another attack at the end of the round. And at first I thought, is that enough choice? But we actually, it creates enormously interesting stories of combat. You know, the narrative of combat arises when players roll the dice and they say, what just happened there was, and there it's free to them to interpret what the result. So if for example, I say do a half attack at you and you do a full parry against me, I might miss and you parry, you then use the number, you can use the number you just rolled as a riposte skill. So immediately you've got players going, you swung at me, I ducked under your blade, and what happened was I then came up, you were left with, maybe I'm left with a half parry. So they're making up the story of the fight from the dice rolls they're getting, and it moves a lot faster than GURPS, I think, to put it that way.
That makes a lot of sense. GURPS is relatively crunchy.
I know. I was all set to drop GURPS or completely hack it to a simpler level until I got 4th edition, and I thought 4th edition it fixes so many things, but I dread, if I said there are 10 bandits step out of the woods as you go along, it would be, oh no, that's the evening gone. In Turikalu, that would be half an hour of brisk and exciting fighting, and then you get on with the rest of the game. So I don't know. At some point, I need to go back to Turekelu and build in more of the other skills, which are there. But back in the 90s, we expected people, you know, it came of an era where if it wasn't covered by the rules, you winged it. And now people expect rules to kind of be there for everything. I mean, I prefer if somebody's going to, let's say, pay an inducement to a bureaucrat and they want to get him to accept it and do what they want. I say to the player, well, tell me what you're saying. You know, if they're an orator and they get up and say, I'm going to try and calm the potential riot down by getting up in the town square and saying such and such, I say, well, say it. Tell me what you say. But GURPS prefers you to kind of tot up all your scores of reaction modifiers and your fast talk or your diplomacy or whatever. And so I need some compromise where those are covered if you want it, but where players who like to just wing a lot of stuff don't feel they're straitjacketed by the rules.
So what prompted you to re-release Turekelu?
I think it was because I met Victor in London. And we were chatting, and I just thought, you know, what have I got that would be fun to just put out there? That I've got a blog that I mostly end up having to talk about game books, you know, solo, choose your own adventure type things, because I wrote them back in the 80s and 90s. And a lot of the fans come for that. But I try to smuggle in role-playing as much as possible. And from time to time, a bit of Tecumel. And I thought, well, they're all people who will not have encountered Turekelu or any of those things. So it gave me a good excuse to do a blog post about Tecumel and to tell them about the rules. And I'm going to do some more, you know, every so often, just trying to wear away the resistance that a lot of people seem to have to Tecumel. I think because they think it's, I was thinking it's kind of like, I'm very into world cinema and things like that. So I'll say to friends, do you want to watch this Inuit 3-hour epic or whatever? Those are great movies, but then they go subtitles, and it's a bit exotic, and they kind of want Game of Thrones, you know? So I have to show people that one of the strengths of Tecumel is that you can use the raw material to make the Tecumel you want. That's what the professor always said. And I think most people need a couple of passes on Tecumel. The first time we played, I mean, give you a good example, my character was called Elric in the very first game we played. And we had no idea, really. But we had because we had read a lot of things like Robert E. Howard and Jack Vance, we knew the fictional tropes that were of the genre, but it took a while to get really into the detail. And I think when we kind of rebooted, we said, let's have a new campaign, then we were getting into, and how do we pronounce these names properly, you know? So we had been, I think we had, people had been saying things like Vimula instead of Vimkla. And we finally sat down and got on top of that. But we had to do the rough one first, effectively. So we had a year of doing that and then came back to it and started to get really into Tecumel. And more and more, the stuff that interests me is the kind of Chekhovian level of rural clan houses. And I don't know if you've seen The Eye of All Seeing Wonder, but things like the
I have Palisar. Seen it. I have seen it in person about right now.
Okay. Well, most of the campaigns that I would write would be things like your grunts in the Palajikala police, or your islanders from such a far-flung part of the empire that they don't really know. They think of themselves as Soliani, but the Soliani themselves aren't that sure about them. And so it's smaller scale stuff, and it's often about clan relationships and it's not saving the world on the whole.
Well, your point of view on Tecumel is clearly well thought out. If you could be persuaded to run a game of Turekelu, I'm sure the Hall of Blue Illumination will help you find the appropriate victims.
Well, I would love to. I've got to brush up on it a bit. I keep trying to get my current players interested. There are many of them are a younger generation who I think are not used to things like, you know, weird tales and science fantasy generally. They're not really. It's kind of like when the John Carter movie came out and kind of bombed, because I think a lot of people just don't get science fantasy. They didn't understand it in a way. And so I am thinking of how I bring players in to take a mel in a way that they don't feel immediately that they have a complex society to grasp. I'm going to try and give them characters who don't need to and kind of stealth them into it, really, I think. And maybe a couple of my old players who keep saying we'd love to have a return to Tegamol, and I can let them play a couple of the actual Soliani guys, and the others can come in from a completely different angle. And maybe I've also got to think in terms of how to reboot the thinking of Tegamol, so that it's, you know, the stuff that interests me is the details that I've got to keep in the background more. And the stuff I present to them has to meet them more than halfway. So I'm thinking that through at the moment. I think I'll probably have to use GURPS, though. Horrific. So that is. Because if I say to them, here's Tirik Helu, they immediately think, then it's Tekamel, and they'll get worried. So I really have to be sneaky about this one.
You know, Dave, it's interesting to hear you say that. I've started a new group of players, and there's four of them, and they're all immensely intrigued by Tekamel. They think it's very, very cool. But at the same time, I realized that I had played in Professor Barker's game for so long that I've been used to doing things and on a much grander scale. And so here they were, they're about 2 months now in Jakala, and they're just beginning to find their way around. And I had to remind myself, it's like, no, don't drop them in the deep end of the pool yet. They still have to figure out what the world is before I start sending them on much bigger adventures.
Yes. I think it's an interesting and fulfilling exercise to come back to basics in a way and try to see Tekamel. It's kind of like, you know, when you have I've had some visitors come over from Japan, and so you show people around your country and you realize that you're starting to see it for the first time in certain ways, because you're starting to see the way they see it. Or when you're talking to a kid and they're talking, a little kid, I mean, and he's talking about the world, and you think, now that's fascinating because we take stuff for granted. So it's kind of like that. It's coming back to this brilliant creation and not being complacent and resting on our laurels with it, but finding a new way to present it to people, which could be a really interesting exercise.
It's important that we, as referees and enthusiasts of the setting, are proactive in presenting it to the up-and-coming generation of role-playing enthusiasts. I think that there's a lot of interest in the early games, and it's just a matter of kind of crossing over into that crowd who expect more of a D&D kind of thing. But there are other games that existed early on, and I think the audience is out there. It's just a matter of doing the legwork to reach out to them.
Yeah, and also not presenting it. I don't really like to present Tekamel to them as old school or anything. It's kind of like, you know, Battlestar Galactica could come back as a new thing, you know, and yet it pays homage to the original, and it structurally looks a lot like a souped-up version of the original. But then it's fresh, and you can do that, present that Tekamel to people that way as well. And it doesn't have to be, I kind of almost don't want to say, look at EPT, because they're going to go, oh, somebody has dusted off an antique. And it's not that at all. It's an interesting world to explore, you know. I don't happen to think a lot of modern systems fit it, partly because there's been a trend, I think possibly from a commercial point of view, of systems that build in story creating mechanisms, like, you know, you have an inciting incident or your character arc is completed. And one of the things I like about Tecamo is that it's basically like a real world rather than a fiction world. So people aren't rewarded for being nice or punished for being bad unless other people do it to them. It's, the world doesn't care. It's a, I did a role-playing game in the 80s called Dragon Warriors, which is a medieval kind of dark fairy thing. And that's a moral and sentimental universe, in the sense that if you that God exists in that, and it's like our God. And so there is a moral, there's a sense that the universe is moral. But Tecamo's universe, the gods are very powerful beings. So it's like the Lovecraftian thing of, well, not quite as bad as Lovecraftian thing, but the gods are not imminent in everything, and observing or caring about how you carry on. And that's what I like. It means that the dice don't, you know, the dice don't lie. If I like to roll in front of the players, and if they get killed, they get killed. And if they succeed brilliantly, they succeed brilliantly. And they know that there's no kind of tweaks to say, you deserved something. It's just, life is like this. And because Tecamo's that kind of a world, I think it's possible to continue and bring it to new.
Well, James, I think you've ended up saying similar sorts of things in terms of the real world quality of Tecamo is something that actually makes it a much richer tapestry to work in.
Yes, I guess so. I mean, it's interesting. Tecamo, well, again, as we were saying before, or as Dave was saying, actually, I mean, the thing about Tecamo is there's a lot of different approaches you can take to it. It has a lot of breadth as well as depth. People, I think, tend to get hung up on sort of the depth of it, which is terrific. But the breadth is really the remarkable thing, that you can play a lot of different kinds of games in Tecamo, like the real world. I often joke that, one of the reasons role players often, or gamers, often dislike modern games, contemporary games set in the real world, is a sort of, well, what do we do? It's like, well, you could do whatever you want. You could have almost any kind of a game. And Tecamo is very much like that. There are certain kinds of campaign setups, I suppose, that are more obvious, you know, but you could really run almost any sort of a game in it. And I think people have. I find it really quite remarkable to hear about what people have done with Tecamo over the years. And many of them are quite different from one another. All the different approaches you can take, they're quite broad. It's a rather remarkable thing, which is why I found it fascinating hearing about your early experiences with Empire of the Petal Throne, Dave. That's quite unlike what I'd ever heard before. I don't know if it's a unique experience, but it's. I'm glad to have heard that.
Well, much later, I was introducing Oliver Johnson, who's one of my players who co-wrote Dragon Warriors with me in the 80s, and I got the map of Tecamo out, and I said, and he was saying, so, wow, there's this whole map, you know, and imagine I'm looking at it from space. He said, well, tell me about the world. So, and we started improvising a game right there, in which he was a space traveler who'd got caught in the event horizon as the Tecamo pocket universe had extracted itself from human space. And he ended up taking that character down to the planet. He lost his spaceship, of course, but he ended up being a player character in the campaign who'd come from that background. And that was all from the possibility, from the fact that it looked so enticing that you could drop in anywhere, that the map is there. And that's true. You look through the source book and there's usually a paragraph or something about everywhere that you can go to. But I think that freedom can be a kind of double-edged sword, because I did a series of choose your own game books in the 90s called Fabled Lands, which are there's a whole bunch of them, and they cover a whole world, and the idea, each book is one region of that world. So if it were Tecamo, there would be a Solianu one, and there would be a Livianu one, and there would be a Salabiani one, and when you reach the border or you get to the port, it will say, go to this paragraph in this other book. And you can do anything. You can be an explorer, you could be a merchant, you could be a warrior or a mage, and you pick up your quests as you go. And I was trying to replicate the feeling I had from Tekemel, which is, you can do anything you want to do now. But it's interesting that a lot of people say to me, when they look at the Fablelands books, but what are you supposed to do? There's like, what's the quest? I go, whatever you like. There's lots of quests there to be found. But isn't there a big story? And you go, well, it's up to you. You know, the big story is your life, isn't it? It's almost there from the start. I get off a boat in Jakala Harbor and I'd like to become the governor of a fief one day. That's what you'd like to aim for. But some people seem to think, if you say you can do anything, it's like, I don't know what to do next. I don't know why they feel that way, but that's something that needs to be addressed as well, that maybe people from so many role-playing games and so many game books start by saying, here's your quest, that you need to maybe give them a bit more of a push in a certain direction. That can be done. It's already there. It can be done by the patrons who approach you in the hostels, or if that's the intro that you do. I mean, typically nowadays, of course, we don't start that way. Most campaigns would start with people already in, middle or high clans, even if they're not very high status, but they're high enough not to be treated as scum, but not so high that they don't have some freedom of, some agency in the world. But, to provide maybe templates or suggestions as to what player characters might actually do might be useful. I don't know. I haven't seen Bethel. Maybe that, does that address this point?
I think we're going to have to ask Jeff D about that in a bit more detail. I was just thinking as you were recounting this that that's also a pattern that happened in Professor Barker's campaign that, yes, the characters, I mean, characters that I played were, mostly from high or very high clans. And we had come up with reasons why we had to go and do the things that we were doing, but mostly in the form of, okay, you're not being expected to fulfill the ordinary duties of a clan member, you get to go and do the special stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And well, in that sense,
And I was just going to say it reminded me talking about, because I was kind of bashing GURPS earlier, and but one of its strengths would be that you could generate a party in which, we had a Tiri Kelu campaign like this in which Oliver Johnson was playing a Tlacatani, but a very poor country cousin. But the sort of guy that, if it were Tolstoy or Chekhov, he'd be an impoverished prince in Russia. But he could still trade off being a Tlacatani a little bit, but he just couldn't push it too far. And the rest of us were the people that he basically had attached as his, I was an extremely low status guy who was really just his kind of skivvy. And but I'd do the nasty jobs that he didn't really want to hear about. But if he said that guy wasn't very nice to me, he wanted to know that the guy might end up in the river or something like that. And GURPS would encourage you to do that because it would say, you can spend your points on status, and then the other players might spend their points on adventuring abilities that support the guy with the status. I mean, Victor, you were telling me about how you normally played the guy in the palanquin.
Yes.
You had other players who were outside the palanquin who did what you wanted to do.
And actually, that was a case of where we were playing in a game that was being run by, I'm trying to remember. I remember it was Patrick Brady. And and so there we were, and everyone turned to me because they knew that I had played with Professor Barker, and so they'd asked me, so we're all the bodyguards. What do bodyguards do under these circumstances? And my response was, I have no idea. And they were like, but why not? It's because I've never played a bodyguard. It's like, I'm the fellow who tells the bodyguard, go take care of that, and I don't worry about what they do. It's, just go deal with that, and I have more important things to handle. you know, please make sure I don't get killed. Excellent. Go, you know, and
actually you mentioned, sorry, you mentioned Patrick, and he, a good example of this, players working at different statuses. He was playing a sergeant to one of the other players' lieutenants in a cohort of a legion, and that led to some very interesting nuances of status interplay and discipline and questions like that. That were, I mean, you need good players for that, obviously. But I think one of the things that Tecmo really encourages and rewards is that is the players to be fans of the setting. You know, that you could play most traditional kind of medieval D&D-ish fantasies and simply turn up, play your game and go home again. But players get into Tecmo on a much deeper level. You know, they want to know others as they play on more and more about it. And then you can appreciate the nuance that it was Jamie Thompson and Patrick were putting into the interplay between their characters. And you could see where, you know, it's kind of like you could see there might be some tension, but if you didn't know the rules of Soliani etiquette, you wouldn't perceive there was any tension at all. And they knew just how to play that. So I think that's one of the other great rewards of playing Tecmo gaming is that the more you play, the more, the deeper you've got in terms of a world. I'm not saying just in terms of the world detail, but in terms of the structures of daily life, etiquette interactions, even the duels I was talking about that we would often have between players in the early days. But they're all parts of the narrative that unfolds ahead of you when you're just playing, you know, whereas there aren't many narrative things, let's say, in a lot of traditional games. It's just, here's the dungeon, you go down, you kill some things. But when you come back up, you have to have a world to know, what do people do? How do they interact? What are the rules of interaction? And Tecmo's got that.
Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, part of the appeal of the game is that there's a society there to learn, to a culture to pay attention to, and that's I think almost all the time that I've ended up playing with new players, one of the things that they comment on is it's so neat to encounter something like that that's so fully realized and different.
Yeah, and I think also there are, and I think this is a good thing, that the new players can. I've been at conventions where we've done games, and the old hand Tecmo players will do things, and after the game, we're chuckling about what happened there. And the new players didn't perceive that they were, you know, the little bits of interaction, you can explain it to them, and they go, oh, yeah. And then 6 months later, they'll be playing, and they'll get it completely. But it means there really is a way of behaving that, if you know Soliani behavior, becomes one of the great things about the game. That that can be, you know, you can imagine that if the average person was simply picked up from, you know, the streets of New York or whatever, just dropped into Soliano, they would be looking, they could be sitting in a room where two people are either friendly or hostile, and they wouldn't read those signs, but the Soliani themselves would read them. And so also do experienced players. So it becomes more fun as you play, I think. It rewards that of getting into the mindset of a Soliani character.
And yet, and this is something James and Scott and I have talked about before, one thing that's, I think, a decent reminder is that the motivations, the sorts of things that, you know, that people have in Tecmo are just the same as here. You know, some people want to be famous, some people want to be rich, some want to have happy family lives, some want to go out and experience everything new. You know, and Professor Barker made a really big point about saying that, you know, people on Tecmo are people. You know, the culture may be different, but the people are still the same. James, you've encountered that a little bit in your games, too.
Oh, yes, definitely. What I was going to say is that I absolutely agree with Dave in terms of the that as you play, the way that you interact with and engage with Techmel as a setting changes the players. I mean, I've observed it. I mean, I'm currently running two different Techmel campaigns, and in both cases, it's fascinating to watch the players go from very early on having very straightforward. I don't mean to denigrate, but sort of, you know, gamey sort of reasons for doing things. Oh, I wish to get money so that I can acquire this thing that I want that will help me to do some other thing. But as they play and become more immersed in the setting and get a better sense of how Tsolyani society works and what the world is like, their motivations change and they begin to start to think like Tsolyani. I know I've mentioned this before, but I mean, one of my favorite portions of one of the two campaigns that I'm running is when the characters were accidentally, through a magical mishap, thrown into another place far from Tsolyani, and they had to make their way back. And as they were going through these other lands and seeing that they did things differently there, suddenly their identities as Tsolyani became very, very clear to them. And they were appalled sometimes at the strange ways of these barbarians. It's like, well, why are they doing that? That's ridiculous. Who behaves in that fashion? And I couldn't help but smile because it was really enjoyable to watch the players sort of become natives, so to speak, through the course of interacting with Techmel. They had become Tsolyani. And that's a wonderful thing. And Techmel, I mean, I don't want to say it's unique in this respect, but it's certainly unusual in being a game setting where it's possible to do that, because there are these societies with different cultural mores and viewpoints that you can pick up and begin to internalize, and you can interact with the setting almost as if you yourself were native. I mean, I can't be the only one who's seen that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So there's the sword. I had a chance after talking with Dave when I was in England earlier this year to just go back through my files, and I was sort of sorting through things more recently, and I found in the midst of everything, since I was the editor of the Imperial Courier back then, that I still have the original depositions from Camiel and Baluri, and this curious case of the steel sword. So, and Dave, I know you were sort of wondering if those things still existed, and so I was very happy to have found them. But
it was great to see even with my little notes, I'd see that we're still on there, their depositions. That was brilliant. Obviously, the getting the ruling from the courts that the professor convened, and also that again it came out with little things that, like the law of the present hand, because then players were saying, if I go up to the necropolis and the tomb guards are going to look for me, but then they're not going to care then if I'm not anywhere near the sarcophagi, the tombs of currently existing clans, because the law of the present hand wouldn't apply. So we were, that immediately caused all these questions to be thrown up. The players were just devouring all of the little kind of bits of information there. But it was fairly typical of the kind of, as I said before, that the players, even though they, probably 2 weeks after that, Canmiel and Baluri would have been adventuring together, there would always be little rivalries and little things they remembered. And of course, they're supposed to, once say they've had a duel, they're supposed to say that's the end of the matter. It's not to be discussed again. But of course, little things like that still become part of the history. It's the sort of thing which in Powered by the Apocalypse would be, a +3 or a -3 or whatever it would be. But it's much more fun to have it as actual history rather than as a number.
Well, so here's this case. Baluri had a steel sword. He died. Conmail came into possession of the steel sword and then sold it ostensibly to pay for a revivification. And once he was back alive again, Valeri was saying, "Where's my sword?" Is that a fair kind of summation of what happened?
They got Valeri had been killed in the underworld, and I suspect what actually happened was that Camille thought, in all the confusion, who's going to notice if I pick up this steel sword and sell it? Then Valeri did notice, and somebody must have said, "Oh yeah, definitely we didn't leave your steel sword. Camille brought it." At which point, you go, "Oh well, it was to pay for your revivification, but luckily you've already been revivified, and here's the money." Although I think it wasn't quite all the money. And then when Valeri went to try and buy his sword back, they were saying, "Oh, it's worth much more than we gave, basically." Of course, he couldn't buy it back at the price that Canriel had given him. So he was seething because he knew really what had happened, that Canriel was just trying to profit by it. But he couldn't just come out and say that in so many words. So, and they were both playing the game, as it were. I mean, the social game of, "Oh, well, I was trying to do you a favor to get you resurrected, but nonetheless you've incompetently lost me the value of my sword, so I'm going to sue you." And yeah, that it even ended up, I think, that Camille bought a kearney and called it Valeri, and that went to Valeri then claimed Champlar, and there was no question that he had been insulted. Camille was trying to bring him into disrepute. Now, Canmiel did have a nice touch in the in his deposition to the court, where he said, "Let me point out the flaws in the albino Baluri's case." And Baluri was an albino, and it was quite possible that the judges maybe assessing the case wouldn't know that. So Canmiel wanted to bring it across, and it couldn't be Champlar because, well, it's completely, I'm not saying anything wrong, I'm just stating a fact. But he wanted them to think less well of Valeri as a result of that. So there's lots of little bits like that that go on, I guess. But that was, yeah, that was a great fun thing. And getting, we got the court's decision from the professor, and that was just absolutely, everybody was very excited about that.
Well,
I don't know if Scott and James have had a chance to look at it, but it's certainly something that I think we could probably post as part of the notes for the podcast.
Oh, I think people would enjoy that. Absolutely. It's a great document, both because you get to see how Professor Barker interacted with fans. I mean, I have talked before about the very generous kind of man that he was in terms of giving his time and in responding to questions and answering often at great length, simply because he enjoyed talking about Tekamel and sort of evangelizing on his behalf. But it's also great too, the way that this letter in turn led to a way to talk more about what Tekamel was like as a place. And you also get, and I know we've talked about this before, a little sense of that difference between game Tekamel and real Tekamel. In the response, in that, you know, well, in real Tekamel, it would be like this, but in game Tekamel, I can totally understand it would be this way. And I thought that was an interesting thing to bring up as well. So it would be terrific to show people, I think.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like a plan. Anything else we'd like to chat about?
I think at some point we might want to actually play a game of Terracalia with Dave, and maybe we could report back on that.
I would love to do that.
Yeah, we could. I never actually tried playing over Skype, but we sometimes used a thing called roles.org, but you don't get a video there. But that can be quite handy for, because you can do the dice rolls on the site. So I recommend that for those little extracurricular bits of gaming where you want to just deal with something with one player. Roles.org is good for that.
Excellent. Well, Dave, thank you very much for being on the show. It's been a great interview. And Yeah, we're really looking forward to learning more about Tony Kalu.
Well, yeah, thanks for having me. You know, I think we're all evangelists for the world of Techamel, and so anything we can do together to get the word out is good. I think it, you know, it's the kind of thing where you feel there's this absolutely amazing thing and I want to share it. Like when you discover a great book or something, you want to tell everybody about it. And it, clearly it's not going to appeal to everyone, but word of mouth is always the best way to let people know about something they could otherwise be missing out on. And I think in the case of Techamel, that's there are lots of people out there who probably would really enjoy it if we could just get them past some of the things that frighten them.
Thank you for listening to the Hall of Blue Illumination. You can email us your questions, queries, and other topics at citizen@techmlpodcast.com. You can also find Techmel Podcast on Twitter and Facebook. Until next time, take care and have fun playing in the world of Techmel.